BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Hello and welcome to another BDNG Meets. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. So today we're here to talk about psychological and psychosocial aspects of alopecia with more focus on male baldness. And this is with Dr. Glenn Jankowski, who is a senior lecturer at Leeds Beckett University. So welcome today, Glenn, and could you quickly introduce yourself and how you became interested and focused on this research project?
Thanks very much for having me. My PhD was in psychology, as you say, in specifically on men and their appearance and how they feel about their appearance. And as many people probably already know, most people today have some area of their appearance they don't like. And of course, for men especially, that this can include hair loss and androgenetic alopecia. That's quite common among men, although also sometimes women as well. And that was an aspect of my PhD findings. I found that come up. And when I started to read the psychological research around that topic, what I noticed in 2014 was there was consistent methodological flaws in that research. Particularly, it was market research surveys looking at men's baldness, psychological impact, which has its strengths but also has its limitations, like the questions are maybe leading or aren't validated, etc. But also I also noticed that there were some funding trends in this research. There was consistent funding from pharmaceutical companies in baldness research, and that piqued my interest. I wasn't aware that there was a funding relationship. I wasn't sure why that was the case, and I wanted to understand what bias that might present as well.
That's really interesting. And I think it's great to have a focus on male, isn't it? Alopecia as well. And I think it's something that's not often talked about, really. And, you know, there is a lot of men out there. I mean, I used to help with the alopecia clinics when I worked in Oxford. And, you know, we had males coming through and they haven't got, I don't think they've got the same support that women actually have as well. So it's really great to have this focus. So when you started off your project, how did you reach out to these males and how did you engage them in the project?
That's a great question. I think it's a real issue with engaging men in research, especially asking them to open up about sensitive issues around body image and embodiment. And it's a challenge we've always found in the research community for men's body image. Whilst that is true, and there are steps we could try and take to undo that. So for instance, instead of asking participants, how do you feel about your appearance? You might ask men, how do men in general feel about their appearance? Or even if you're feeling great, what are the pressures on other men? So we try and get around that. It's called the third person effect. Or we might try and bring in adverts into a focus group or interview session and say, actually, look at this advert. Let's confront this together. What are we reading? Rather than abstractly asking participants what are the appearance pressures you face. With that in mind, though, I have noticed, as you're probably aware, women face really extensive appearance pressures, including around their hair and alopecia. And alopecia can be common in women. And so I've always found a struggle not to erase the pain and added pressures women face compared to men. When we've done empirical analyses of men's magazines and websites, what we found is that there are high appearance pressures for men, but the women's appearance pressures are always up here. And so I've always found it difficult to compare the two because I never wanted to erase what women's pain is, which sometimes happens in the research community. So men do have these gendered disclosure issues when it comes to their embodiment. They're less able to talk about it, as you alluded to, and women share those concerns more easily with each other. But women's pressures are still higher.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? There is a difference definitely there, and I think sometimes, well, obviously, as we know, social media adds to the pressures of, how we look, and people have this thought process of how they look and how people see them, isn't it? I mean, a lot is related to stigma issues as well, how they perceive other people are looking at them or thinking, which isn't always the case as well. And it's really great that, you've engaged the male population in this, because as we know, it's sometimes a bit more tricky to engage males in topics, especially when it comes to their appearance. You mentioned a couple of interesting aspects there. I've got a couple of questions on what you were talking about. The bird person effect, could you just go into a bit more detail of what that means, just for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. That's a trend, a bias in research that is common, that researchers have to overcome in some way. It's a challenge. So it's where participants generally or individuals tend to underestimate how phenomenon affects themselves. It's easier to think of ourselves as atomic, as able to control our lives and that we're feeling better than we actually are, or that external pressures don't affect us. So researchers suggest that what people should do to overcome that is ask participants questions about how other people are likely to be affected. The big example, of course, is media pressures. Most people don't accept that media pressures personally affect them, but they will accept that they affect other people. Another example, actually very relevant to dermatology, is doctors will say that receiving gifts from pharmaceutical companies or pens have no influence on their medical care at all. And in fact, they'll happily receive more gifts, but they'll be concerned about the colleagues' practices that might have been commercially influenced, which I think is fascinating.
That's really interesting. It's really fascinating, isn't it? And thinking about that concept actually as well. Yeah, and I must admit, when I dabbled in psychology with my master's, it was a really interesting topic to think about, these different how things affect different people, isn't it? It's really, really fascinating. So that was really interesting, Glenn, how you've concentrated on the male perception of alopecia. So there is a big difference, I'd say, between maybe the age groups. So maybe a 20-year-old may look at social media more in a different way even than maybe people in their 50s. So how did you break it down? Did you have specific age groups, or how did you compile your research?
Yeah, age is definitely a complex factor that influences general body image experiences, including alopecia experiences. And there are two different ways age can impact that are a little bit hard to separate. So one is generational, so that people born in 2000s or 1990s have grown up with social media. Their phones are more commonly attached to their eyes, at all times. Compared to those born in the 60s and the 50s, who are a bit less social media-ified, if you like. So there's generational differences. And then there are, I think, I should get this right, cohort differences, or maybe that's actually what generational differences are. There are essentially differences between 50-year-olds and 20-year-olds, no matter what time period each were born in, as you indicate. So with boldness experiences and the psychological impact of boldness, what m many men with boldness say is that yes, initially it was hard to lose my hair and there were changes to my identity. I had concerns, I had some distress, but over time, my perspective really changed. I grew to embrace boldness, I loved it. And they often advise younger men, give it a couple of years, give it, and your psychological perspective will change. You might even see it as generally a positive thing, as an experience that's helped you grow, that's shaped your perspective, that reduces how superficial you are to other people, because you see that this dead matter on top of our heads isn't, as essential as we were told it was. So there are really complex factors with age, and it can be difficult to research. At the same time, I think it's the British Association of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons, BAPRAS. They released a statement recently to their credit saying young men on social media are developing high anxiety and they're sometimes going for inappropriate hair restoration surgeries. And they warned against this and said young men need to know hairlines mature and change as we age, and that's very, very normal, and that hair restoration surgery should be a really considered and thoughtful process. We shouldn't rush into it. And they blamed aggressive marketing on social media. So the research that I've led has focused a bit more on young men because I feel that they're most vulnerable when it comes to male baldness.
Yeah, that's that, because I do remember, you know, there's definitely celebrities out there that have obviously said about her restorative surgery. And yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of money as well that can be spent. I mean, that's a good focus really on the products that are advertised out there for, you know, alopecia and, you know, the miracle cures, etc. Did you find in your research that this was a bit of a focus that you had to focus on with the male? Did they spend a lot of money? Have they used products that have just been a waste of time or actually, in fact, quite dangerous sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I could be a competent psychological researcher or sociological researcher without looking at the environment that people are living in. And that environment is often marketed towards them. There are products that are pushed towards people that change how we view our bodies and how we relate to our appearances, including our hair. So a competent social researcher must account for that. I really believe that. And once you ask men, what we know from individual balding men, but also balding practitioners, so hair loss transplant surgeons and trichologists, that their knowledge is often in line with marketing information around anti-baldness products. So that is the dominant information we receive. It comes from a company marketing some kind of anti-baldness product when it comes to baldness. Unfortunately, it's those companies that have the bigger marketing budgets that have extensive PR experts that can get their messages out there. And common messages, unfortunately, with baldness from these companies is that it's severely psychologically distressing, that it will result in discrimination, severe discrimination, that it can lead to suicide and other large impacts, profound impacts, that it is a medical disease. Those key messages are promoted from companies and they get inside us, including myself and other balding men, and they shape their behaviours as well. And they push specifically to find hair transplants or drugs that sometimes have side effects and have risks. It's interesting when looking at the history of baldness, though, because obviously there's always been, attempted baldness cures in history. They can always be found, including from ancient Egypt. The papyrus papers had a baldness animal dung based cure in them. So those have always existed. Obviously, especially in the 20th century and the 19th century, these were always seen really as snake oil. They were ineffective. They weren't regrowing hair and sometimes really dangerous too. Since the late 80s, 90s, two major products have been approved by regulators for baldness, finasteride and minoxidil. And obviously hair transplants can also restore the appearance of a full head of hair. And it's difficult because I want to be nuanced. Those products have some value to them and they might prevent further baldness. They're not particularly good, any of them, at regrowing hair back to its full head of hair state as somebody might wish to have. But nonetheless, it should always be a considered process. All of them have side effects or carry expense, and many bald men and people can have baldness, wear wigs or use cosmetic interventions that aren't as systematic, that don't change the hormones as finasteride may do, or just bear their baldness, shave their heads or let their recessed hair grow and be happy with that. And I think it's always reminding balding men that they have choices and options and should feel able to choose any.
That's great, just having the reassurance though that they've got choices, and everyone's an individual, aren't they, Glenn? I mean, that's the fact that, you know, we all cope differently, and gosh, amazing that it goes back so far in the history as well, which is quite fascinating. So when you're seeing these patients, seeing these men, do you see them face to face, or do they answer like a series of questions? Because if you've seen them face to face and they express, you know, like you were mentioning, the even suicidal thoughts, etc. I mean, how do you support these, you know, participants in your research? And is there any particular signposting that you would provide for these men, which would also be very helpful for our listeners today?
Yeah, that's a great point. So obviously I'm not a qualified clinical psychologist or therapist, so unfortunately I'm not able to support anyone in mental distress in a qualified scientific way. I'm just a researcher in this area, and I do feel responsibility to you know, as many hair transplant surgeons or dermatologists do, we share a responsibility and want our the people we come into contact with to get the right support. And unfortunately there isn't much for alopecia related distress, psychological distress. There are some exceptions, luckily, and one in particular I recommend is the evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapy online program called Face It at Home. And this was set up by Centre for Appearance Researchers for any person who feels distressed with visible differences. And that can include alopecia if the person accepts that as a visible difference, but it can also include other aspects like visible scars or port wine stains. And it helps people cope with social situations and potentially limited flawed thinking around that visible difference. So Face It at Home is something I definitely recommend, and the founders are really generous at sharing that for free. And there's different pathways of self-referral or referral to a GP. And then I would also recommend some of the charities around alopecia, Alopecia UK notably, but also there are acceptance groups for balding men. Some of these have moved online now, such as I think it's called the Hair Loss Cafe by Harry James on YouTube. It's a really great community of men who accept their hair loss and shave their heads typically and share their wisdom from that. And I think those spaces can be really useful. And Alopecia UK have great role models that wear boldness and that, you know, wear bold heads and rock them. And
I do.
Yeah.
100% they do. And that's some, I think, you know, a lot of our listeners have engaged with Alopecia UK, definitely. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to meet some of these people that work there, and just fantastic. And that's some really good other links there as well. Face It at Home, that's one I've particularly not heard of, so that'd be really great for our listeners as well to have a look at those. And I think it's important, you know, as again, as a clinician, when I see patients, you know, I'm not mental health trained, you know, if a patient does sort of express suicidal thoughts, I mean, you have to go to different layers of clinicians, don't you, because, you know, we're not all expert in every field. So I think you've hit the nail on the head by expressing that, you know, we do have to signpost patients, or we do have to, you know, go to different clinicians just to get their expert help. And I think the main thing with what you've done, Glenn, is actually focusing on male baldness, which is fantastic, and giving these men opportunity to express how they feel, you know, maybe have added support, you know, engagement with others. It's all really fantastic work that you've done. So speaking about the work that you've done, have you got any plans to further do any further research on this particular topic, or how do you feel that you can get your work out there?
Thank you very much. It's really kind of you. And, you know, I really appreciate the platform to try and disseminate some of the research messages myself and colleagues have made, because we want our research to be helpful to people, really, we really do. And academic platforms aren't necessarily the best way to do that, especially in an expensive journal article. So with that in mind, our recent work, myself, Dirk Kranz and Josip Razum, who are independent researchers of boldness, and we've collaborated the last 1 or 2 years, but we're independent researchers at different institutions, have produced and designed a series of animated videos. They're short, about 2 minutes, and they take a different aspect of men's boldness and they try and promote evidence-based information about it. It's we're very lucky to have a fantastic video animator, Sakshat Joshi, who we recommend. And we've got 5 of the videos currently out at the moment. They're on YouTube, and then accompanying multiple choice quizzes that people can use once they've watched the video to try and, you know, further their knowledge. And we're working on finishing those videos, the full set of 8, and then disseminating them. And then I also have set up a small website. It's called the Bolding Buddy, and it's designed to promote evidence-based information for men's boldness. And it tries to show some of the history of boldness, the positive interpretations that we've had in our society over time, and then signpost to further support as well.
Wow, that's amazing, the work you've done, and really build on that. I love the Bolding Buddy idea as well. That's fantastic, really fantastic. Well, the good news is, hopefully, Glenn, that obviously our listeners will be able to listen to this, and hopefully I'll also have you in our BDNG journal, so you can also promote your work through that, and we'll definitely be in discussion about that, so we can then link this valuable podcast to the journal article too, so we can make all that happen for you within the BDNG, definitely. It's so interesting, so fascinating. And I think, you know, there's been some really helpful tips for our listeners there to where to sort of signpost our patients to. So before we leave today, Glenn, I mean, I could speak to you for a lot longer, but before we leave today, could you just again just repeat those key sort of signposting platforms for our listeners that could they could signpost their patients to?
Yeah, so if you come into contact with a patient distressed by their alopecia, there are a couple of screening measures you can implement to assess how significant that distress is. Those are available online. My colleague Josip Razum has one. I list it on the boldingbuddy.wordpress.com site I have. Then if they do need support, then there are support organisations. Obviously, Alopecia UK is one, Face It at Home. Dr. Esther Hansen, a clinical psychologist based in London, specialises in alopecia and body image distress as well. And then just generally, obviously, for any distressed person with alopecia or any person considering what they should do with their alopecia, I would recommend obviously advising them. It's really important to know the advantages and disadvantages of different interventions, whether that's pharmaceutical, finasteride or JAK inhibitors, that more recently for alopecia areata. It's important to know the disadvantages and side effects of them, and to know the realistic efficacy that they have, to see that sometimes they're good at regrowing some hair, and that's you know, really important for some people. And then to consider, well, some people bear boldness, some people wear wigs, some people have a mix of these interventions, and any response is okay, and you should feel able to pick any response. I think those messages are quite powerful.
That's really powerful messages, yeah, and great to get across. And yes, within working in secondary at the moment, obviously we're getting a lot in the media about the new medications that are coming through, you know, for alopecia. And, you know, we basically have a waiting list already for people wanting to go onto these medications. But you're right, we do have to assess everything. We have to assess the side effects, the, you know, the efficacy, the actual treatment, how it actually works. You know, it's all this that we have to assess and make sure our patients, it's the right treatment for our patients, because the media are very good at portraying these miracle cures, and, you know, this has changed lives, and, you know, it's difficult for us to have that one-to-one meeting with these patients. So thank you so much. That's absolutely fascinating work, Glenn, and well done for you for, you know, focusing on this topic as well. And I'm sure all the men that participated in this project were, you know, really well supported, and also, you know, felt listened to. I think that's the important thing, isn't it? I mean, just having that voice that they can actually be felt listened to as well. So I look forward to working with you in the near future. Thanks again for spending your time with the BDNG today. And we look forward to hearing more from you very soon. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.